So we've had a year of Donald Trump, and some of our worst nightmares have been realized. Those of us who live on the East Coast know Donald Trump very well. We know that he's a real unsavory character with mafia ties and all kinds of nefarious activities. And now a lot of the rest of the country who had an idea have realized that this guy is, there's something going on here that's really negative. What kind of reaction do you think we're going to get? I mean, are people really organizing? Do you think that the organization will be successful? Are we close to having some kind of formation, some kind of opposition, or are we still just floundering?
Well, I think there is an opposition to Trump. I think it's a very a broad type of opposition. There's definitely an opposition to Trump. Now, when you say opposition, I'm presuming that you mean a left opposition.
Exactly.
And as far as the left is concerned, the left seems to be divided on how to approach Trump. I mean, there are some people who think it's important to be part of this broad opposition that's been called the quote-unquote resistance, you know, to Trump. And then there are other people, when I listen to them, I'm more than if they support Trump the way they talk. I'm talking about people on the left.
This is Radio Justice, the name of this program. This is Radio Justice. The name of this program is Emanations, and my name is Bernard White. One of the important and respected organizations on the East Coast is the People's Organization for Progress. This is Radio Justice, the name of... This is Radio Justice. The name of this program is Emanations, and my name is Bernard White. One of the most important and respected organizations on the... This is Radio Justice. The name of this program is Emanations, and my name is Bernard White. One of the most important and respected organizations, activist organizations on the East Coast, is the People's Organization for Progress, also known as POP. The chair of this organization for over 30 years is Lawrence Ham. Larry Ham is a dynamic spokesperson with a good sense of history. Periodically, we've had lengthy discussions on a variety of topics. Today, I'm going to share one of those discussions with you. Larry Ham.
There are some people who definitely see the need to get rid of Trump. I think the left understands it in broader terms, that you got to get rid of the whole regime, even break the hold of the Republican Party on Congress. And then there are some people who see that, and then some see the need for structural change in the system. And I'm kind of in all of those camps. I mean, I think all of that should be part of a unified approach to Trump. I don't think it's an either or. I don't think it's like, we get rid of Trump or we change the system. We get rid of Trump in the process we work to change the system. You understand what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
I think it's a multi-dimensional approach. I think, yes, Trump must be defeated. His regime has to go. We got to break the hold of the Republican Party on government right now. They got the White House. They got the Congress, and they got the Supreme Court. And on top of that, they got state legislatures all over the country. In fact, they are almost at that point, that number of state legislatures that they control, that they could actually call a constitutional convention and amend the Constitution and change the entire, you know, makeup of government into something that they want, you know. But I think it's all of that, including the need for fundamental transformation. But look, if we can't even get people elected to office, how are we going to change the system, you know? So I think it should be all part of an integrated, overarching strategy that involves all of that. I think more than half of the country right now realize that Trump has to go. And I think we should support that effort, whether it be through impeachment, whether it be through resignation, or whether, you know, it be at the ballot box in 2020. I think we should definitely be part of the broad united front to get rid of Trump. But I don't think we should stop there. You know, we got to get rid of Trump, his regime, his old cabinet, everybody that he's appointed to all these agencies. We got to, you know, break the hold of the right-wing Republicans on the government, which includes the House, the Senate, the White House, and the Supreme Court, you know. And at the same time, we have to work for more fundamental, radical transformation, because it wasn't no paradise before Donald Trump. You know, it wasn't no paradise under Bill Clinton. It wasn't no paradise under George W. Bush. It wasn't no paradise under any of those other presidents. You know, it wasn't no paradise under neoliberal Bill Clinton. You know, in fact, one could make argument, and this is where I agree with some of, you know, my very left friends, is that, yes, in part, the whole neoliberal strategy has helped to bring us to Donald Trump. You know, the Trump outcome has been something that's been in the works for 40 years. And I would go back to Barry Goldwater, the election of 64. Wasn't that 64 when Goldwater ran?
Uh-huh.
You know, Goldwater was showing, you know, the making of the ultra right in embryo back then, the kind of stuff that Goldwater was saying in the campaign. You know, most people take it back to Nixon, but Nixon, you know, essentially moved to the right because of Goldwater. You know, moved further to the right because he was already a Republican. He was already on the right. But Barry Goldwater set that stage, man, and helped set the stage for that strategy that Nixon called the Southern Strategy. You know, because remember, Lyndon Johnson, he pissed a lot of them Southern Democrats off. And he said as much. He said, by signing this bill, I'm going to lose the South. And he did, and that's what happened. The South left the Democratic Party and began to migrate into the Republican Party. They began with Goldwater and, you know, kind of reached the zenith, you know, with Nixon, his first campaign in 68 and his second campaign in 72,
mm-hmm.
where he won by a landslide. You know, I don't see this stuff as like all of a sudden. This is not any all of a sudden stuff to me. Donald Trump didn't come out of thin air, you know. You know, Donald Trump is the product of a process that's been going on for half a century in this country, ever since the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement. Because a lot of this reaction is really rooted in the issue of race, racism, white supremacy. You know, and these people who support Trump, you know, this is the kind of the, I don't know whether I should call it the last gasp, you know, of you know, American of the last gasp of American apartheid, or whether it's the first gasp of the neo-fascist movement of the 21st century.
That racist reactionary tendency has always been there.
Yes.
Before we go on, I want you to, can you describe the Southern strategy for listeners who may not know just what that is?
Well, the Southern strategy was essentially the move that Nixon made to woo the white Democrats, the white racist Democrats. See, before Nixon, there was what was called the Dixiecrats. These were the Southern Democrats. And a lot of people don't know, certainly most activists know, but a lot of folks don't know that the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and was the party opposed to slavery and was the party that prosecuted the Civil War. The Democratic Party was the party of the slaveholder. And, you know, for a long time, well into the 20th century, most blacks were Republicans and the Southern whites were Democrats. And that pretty much was the case until the Civil Rights Movement. And there was such a white backlash against the Civil Rights Movement and against Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, which was definitely not just a social change, but was a threat to white apartheid power in the South, because it essentially enabled the political empowerment, it facilitated political empowerment of black people who couldn't vote. And then once they got to vote, you know, they voted out a lot of these white racists, and black elected officials were elected all over the South. In fact, people were calling it the Second Reconstruction. You know, remember after the Civil War, there were the Reconstruction governments. Mm-hmm. These were the state legislatures that black people elected in the Southern states. Some of them were predominantly black, and some of them were a mixture of white populace and black, you know, Reconstructionists. And so we had a similar kind of thing happen after the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 64, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. So white folks were upset. There was a white backlash against the Civil Rights Movement. And Nixon put together a strategy to woo these white Democrats that were dissatisfied with the Democratic Party because of their support for civil rights. So Nixon wooed them. He wooed them not by using outright racist language, but essentially using kind of cold language that didn't leave anything to be second guessed with the white folks, that, you know, he was opposed to civil rights and he was for law and order and on and on and on. And so Nixon used that approach to woo the white Democrats, not only to vote for him, but to in fact defect from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And that really laid the basis for the political arrangement that we have today, with the Republican Party essentially being the party of the white man now, you know, and the Democratic Party, you know, being a more multiracial. Both are capitalist parties, both are corporate parties, but it's pretty clear that the Democratic Party is the party of whatever meager reforms can be won under the current arrangements, and the Republican Party is the party of the status quo, to keep the status quo. In fact, not even just to keep the status quo. Now is the party whose agenda is to turn back the clock on civil rights, women's rights, workers' rights, anybody's damn right. The only rights they protect are the right of the corporations to make as much profit as they possibly can, and which is what they have been doing. Mm-hmm.
I like your idea of an integrated approach to developing an opposition. However, on the left is this notion of purity where things have to be a particular way, and it always winds up having the left fighting against itself.
That's right. That's right. And we fight ourselves, and we keep ourselves out of power. You know, Bernard, I ran at the third party campaign. I ran for the state. Me and Arthur Kanoy had a ticket together in 1987. We ran for state legislature. So I'm speaking from experience. And, you know, a lot of people, including myself at one time, we would like to see a third party come into being. But it just ain't happening right now. And all the third parties together can't get more than 1 or 2% of the total votes cast in this country. So they're not really a viable alternative. The masses of black people who do vote, because probably half of the masses of black people don't vote, they're turned off from the system. But the masses of black people who do vote, they're Democrats right now. And that's a reality that we have to come to grips with. I support the right of people to form third parties. I support the right of third parties to run candidates. I support the right of people to be third party candidates. I support any reforms that will make it easier for third parties to get ballot access. But because I support all of that, still doesn't mean I see that as a viable strategy. Take the Green Party, for instance. In the last election, I don't think the Green Party got more than 1% of the total votes cast. And the Green Party is probably the most viable of the third parties on the left that we have. So we have to really, you know, examine this third-party strategy. Personally, I think we need third parties because some people are so turned off from the two-party system that they'll never vote for either one of them. So if there's a party that they can vote for, then that's good. I'm glad. And that's one way. And the other way that third parties can play a valuable role is by raising these issues. But electorally, that is, the ability to get people elected to office, they just haven't demonstrated. And I know the Greens say, well, we have a person elected here and we have a person elected there. In most of those situations, I won't say all because I don't know all the situations, but in most of those situations where third-party people were able to get elected, they ran in nonpartisan elections. Like in the city of Newark, when people run for the city council in the city of Newark, they don't run as Democrats or Republicans. Our elections, municipal elections, are nonpartisan. But East Orange, which is right next door to Newark, their elections are partisan. It's an all-black town, but when they run, when they have elections, they have a black Democrat and they have a black Republican running. And I think where third-party people have gotten elected, most of the time, not all, but most of the time, you know, it's where you had a nonpartisan election and people ran, you know, basically as individuals and, you know, basically on their own merit, so to speak. And there's always the exception to the rule, you know, but the exception sometimes, in fact, proves the rule. And we have to have a political strategy that will not only speak to people who are so alienated from the system that they'll vote for third parties, but we must also have a strategy that speaks to the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in this country who are registered as Democrats, but who will support a left platform. And that's what Bernie Sanders' election proved. Bernie Sanders proved that there are millions, literally millions. He won 22 states. I think 13 million people, I think, voted for Sanders. He won 22 primaries, and so on and so forth. He proved that there's a left wing within the Democratic Party, and our strategy must also address them. How can we address only the couple of hundred that, like in New Jersey, we just had a gubernatorial election. We had five candidates that were independent, that were neither Democrat nor Republican. And one of them, very talented, articulate young man, young white fella, Seth Capperdale from Highland Park. He's a pastor there. and he ran. And quite frankly, if you brought all the candidates together, Democrats and Republicans and independents, he sounded the best. We let him in pop. He came and addressed POP twice, you know, once during the primary, before the primary election, and once before the general election. And but when you looked at the election returns, there were other independents that got more votes than Seth. There were people that just ran on their own and got more votes than the Green Party candidate. You understand what I'm saying, Bernard? We just can't talk to the 1% of the people that will support third party. We got to talk to the quote-unquote masses, the millions of people. You know, Green Party supported $15 minimum wage. Bernie Sanders supported $15 minimum wage. You know, Green Party supported universal health care. Bernie Sanders supported universal health care. There are many people within the Democratic Party who support the same reforms that many of our third parties, our left third parties, also support. So we have to have a strategy that is multidimensional, and at least two facets of it. One is inside the Democratic Party, and the other is outside the Democratic Party.
Well, I think you're right on it, but there are, you know, one of the things that I did several years ago, I remember being on the radio and we were talking about the elections, and I said that I thought that it would be good that if there was a variety of independent parties, if you had a black independent political party, a Latin independent political party, poor white people's independent political party, and whoever else wanted to have one, and that these folks would come together as a group, hammer out their platform. And I would bet that 90% of the platform would all be the same. Okay, so those are the things that we agree on. The other things we can struggle around. But, you know, one of the things that I think that the left has to understand, or it doesn't really understand yet, is that you have to come up with a protracted struggle, a protracted strategy, that this is not going to happen overnight, that you're talking about replacing, dismantling a racist system that has been racist for hundreds of years, that has been pro capitalism for 100 or so years. That, you know, it's going to require that you do things in stages. But I don't see that.
Right. And that strategy would be a particularly viable strategy if we had a parliamentary type system in the United States, like they have in all the Europe, just about in all the other countries in the world, you know, they have, including England, they have a parliamentary system. We in America, we have a winner-take-all system. You get 50 plus 1% of the vote, 51% of the vote, you get the whole thing. It doesn't work like that in other countries. In other countries, if you get 51% of the vote, you get 51% of the power. You get 51% of the representatives in the Congress. You don't get the whole thing, you know? And what exists in America, the two parties have conspired, I think, both consciously and also in terms of the dynamics of how our system works. The two parties have conspired, essentially, to set up a system that locks third parties out. They are locked out. Now, they are not locked out legally. People can legally form parties, but the obstacles that they have to overcome to actually get on the ballot and actually win elections make it almost impossible for them to succeed. Now, there will always be the exception to the rule. There will always be some individual who's so popular that they will defy the odds and end up beating. We had one. We had one in New Jersey in my lifetime, and he was a racist, and he was on the right. Don't just think that the third parties will all be on the left. There'll be third parties on the right too.
Talk about Anthony Imperiale.
That's right, Anthony Imperiale. He got elected as an independent to the state legislature in New Jersey in the early 1970s. But he was on the right. But he didn't last too long, you know, because essentially he couldn't get much done, you know, by himself in a state legislature that had, I believe, their 100 and some odd seats in the assembly and another 40 seats, I believe, in the Senate, in the state Senate. So even though he personally got elected, you still have to have a majority to get things done. That's why Bernie Sanders, who is an independent from Vermont, he caucuses with the Democrats. Because the Democrats would rather, as Lyndon Johnson said, rather have him pissing inside the tent than pissing outside on the tent. You know, inside pissing out the tent than rather outside pissing on the tent.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And this is the problem. And on top of that, it's money. It's a system that's driven by money. And it takes literally millions. Remember, in both the Obama election and in the Hillary Clinton election, they both spent nearly $1 billion, or maybe more than $1 billion, on their campaigns. $1 billion is 1,000 million. Don't no little third parties have that kind of money. You know, most of them can't even get, talk about run for president, most of them can't even get a candidate on all 50 state ballots. You serious about getting elected for president, you got to be on the ballot in all 50 states and the territories where people are allowed to vote for president. So our system is structured to keep out any real independent effort. Now, does that mean it shouldn't be independent? No, I'm not saying that. I just said that I think there is a role for third parties in terms of, you know, mobilizing people who would otherwise be sitting down because they're so alienated and dissatisfied, and also raising the radical issues. I think that's a valuable role, the progressive issues that third party plays. But in terms of actually impacting the governmental system, the electoral system, I don't see how we can do it without participating in the elections. It's almost as if, remember Fannie Lou Hamer, when she went to Atlantic City, she went as part of the delegation from the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Right.
Now, it wasn't the Mississippi Freedom Party. It was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the MFSD, all right, MFDS or whatever it was, you know what I'm saying. They didn't go as a third party. They went as what they perceived to be the legitimate integrated delegation from Mississippi, as opposed to the all-white apartheid Democratic Party delegation that had been seated. And I'm kind of thinking that is the strategy that we need to pursue. Fannie Lou Hamer organized the progressive Democrats within the Democratic Party of Mississippi and challenged the status quo Democrat, at that time, the white apartheid Democrat, challenged them. And I think that similarly, our strategy must include organizing within the Democratic Party, because that's where the overwhelming majority of the masses of people are, especially when you talk about black people. That guy, Doug Jones, who elected him? Who got him elected? Black people. Black women who voted 98% for Jones in Alabama, and black men, because they talk about the women, but they don't talk about the men, black men who voted 94%. Both unheard of percentage-wise in terms of demographics.
Well,
there's no other group that votes like that. They can say, yeah, 98% of the vote when, you know, nobody else votes like that.
Yeah, I think Obama showed that when the black community feels that they have a candidate that is going to represent their interests, that they'll come out and vote.
Yes, yes. So I think that part of our strategy has to be that, you know, there must be some organizing like Bernie Sanders did in terms of running progressive Democrats in the primary elections. There really shouldn't be an election if we can help it. I know, and I'm speaking theoretically now because I know this is not going to work out practically, but theoretically, we shouldn't have a primary election where we're not running progressive Democrats who are running on the Bernie Sanders-type platform. I mean, that's the only way we're going to move the Democratic Party to the left, and that's the only way we're going to consolidate those 13 million or more progressive Democrats that voted for Bernie Sanders. I know Sanders is up in age, and I know the last election was probably very taxing on him, but I hope he runs again. I hope he can squeeze out one more run, because the task of consolidating all those progressives who voted for Sanders is not yet finished. You know, Bernie got it started. He openly identified himself as a democratic socialist. He was for the 15 minimum wage. He was for cutting the military budget, and on and on and on. We should have somebody like that in every presidential election, in every U.S. Senate election, in every congressional election. This is how you build a constituency. You know, this is one of the ways. It's not the only way. It's one of the ways that must be pursued to consolidate the progressive vote in the United States. That's really what has to happen.
Well,
you know, otherwise, I don't see a whole lot of other stuff having a lasting impact.
You know, much of the left is looking for perfection. And if there's any imperfections, and, you know, Bernie had some things that you would disagree with.
Right.
But, you know, you're not going to get perfection unless you control the process and you can put in exactly who you want. But you had mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer a little while ago, and I was just thinking... Mm-hmm. That, you know, they were doing broadcasting that convention that year on TV. However, when Fannie Lou Hamer came to the microphone, they cut and went to commercial. So even the media at that time was complicit in trying to delegitimize that effort.
And they're still complicit. They ain't changed. The media helped put Donald Trump in office. The media would rather point a camera for 45 minutes at an empty chair where Donald Trump doesn't show up rather than cover a rally that Bernie Sanders has had. That's what happened in the last presidential campaign. The media helped make Donald Trump, just like the president of CBS said. He said Donald Trump is good for our rating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the media is part of the problem. You know, and I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised that NPR gave time to the independent candidate. Of course, they didn't give the equal time, but they gave time to the Green Party candidate, you know, in the last election. Even in the gubernatorial election, I think Seth Capperdale was interviewed by NPR, you know, and given a chance to talk about his platform and stuff like that. So, you know, that makes public media a little bit different, not a whole lot different, but a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
one of the things that we need to keep our eye on is the election of Chokwe Lumumba's son.
Right.
I think he is... He has brought together some, you know, very progressive platform. And
right.
It would be interesting to see how the powers that be respond to that platform.
Right. Now, did they have a partisan or nonpartisan election?
I'm not sure.
You need to find out.
Yeah.
Because people say, well, you know, Chuck Wei is a progressive. I think he's a progressive Democrat. I think he ran in the primary and won. That's what I think. It's like Charles Barron, right?
Mm-hmm.
People think Charles Barron is a third-party candidate. Charles Barron is a Democrat.
Right.
Now, he's a Democrat of a different type, and he's clearly not under the control of the establishment Democratic Party. He's an independent Democrat, but he is in the Democratic Party and runs in the Democratic Party primary.
Well,
and
I think most
people, when they hear Charles Barron talking, they think he's a third party independent candidate. But he is. He's independent, but he's an independent Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he recognized that, you know, if he went another way, he wouldn't win.
Exactly. That's exactly my point, Bernard. If he went another way, he had to go that way to win. Bernie Sanders was an independent who beat the Democrats and the Republicans in the U.S. Senate race year after year in Vermont. Why did he join the Democratic Party to run for president? Because there was no other vehicle that could possibly bring him even anywhere near the possibility of winning a presidential election. Bernie Sanders he's more of an independent than Charles Barron. Bernie Sanders is a third-party person. He just doesn't have a party. He's an independent personality who has beaten both the Democrats and Republicans in races from the level of mayor all the way up to U.S. Senate in Vermont. But he had to join the Democratic Party to run for president because that was the only way he could reach a large enough constituency to even put a dent in the thing, and he did quite well, I think. He got like a third of the vote. In New Jersey, he got like 36 to 38% of the vote cast. And he did a profound service to us. He demonstrated that there is a clearly defined constituency for progressive politics in this country. It's just an unfortunate reality that we have to work through the existing political structure to make that happen. Now, I know about the sister, the Indian sister up there in Seattle, Savant.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, she's genuine. She's genuine third party. She's not, I don't think she was Green Party, though. I think they had a nonpartisan election up there. That's how she got elected. But I could be wrong. But whether it was partisan or nonpartisan, she is a genuine independent, you know, and she's the exception that proves the rule. Ralph Nader, in his last book, I forgot the title of it, but in his last book, Ralph Nader put out the reasons why it's almost impossible for third party to succeed in the United States. And he should know because he's run as a third party candidate
several
for president
times. Yeah.
Several times. But he lays it out in his and I actually heard him in an interview on Democracy Now! Talk about the structural problem, the structural hurdle that third parties cannot possibly overcome that prevent them from getting power in this country. You know, but we still should support the right of people to form third parties, to run third party candidates, and we should support reform that make it easier for third parties to get ballot access. I think we should do that.
But you know, that requires a lot of information. You know, one of the things that annoyed me during the course of Obama's administrations,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of the left spent a whole lot of time giving a negative critique of Obama among...
And they still do it. And they still doing it.
Right.
You think Obama, with some of these people, you think Obama was still president.
Right.
Or did Hillary, they talk so much about Hillary Clinton, you think she was president?
So what I'm saying is that we wasted a lot of time. It was a time to begin to educate people that,
right.
About how this system actually works. And
right.
not, you know, see Obama as some deregulate kind of demon that we always face. But, you know, recognize what constraints were on him and understand how the system works. And we don't have a way of getting that information out. You had mentioned about independent media a little while ago. It has fallen by the wayside. It has hasn't fulfilled its responsibility to really go where there is a need and bring that to the public and have to have these kind of discussions. They pretty much follow a similar line as corporate media.
Right. And it's a shame, you know. And, you know, it's how our predatory capitalist system, you know, reflects itself in the political system. You know, one system mirrors the other. You know, our political system very much mirrors our economic system with the tendency toward monopoly and everything else. I mean, look at the media. The media is controlled now. When Sinclair closes this, when the Sinclair Corporation closes this deal, there will be essentially four major corporations that control almost all the media in the United States. Four. In our political system, basically two parties control the politics of the nation. So you got oligopoly in one place and you got oligopoly in the other. You know, you got economic oligopoly and you got political oligopoly. You know, they reflect each other. And it kind of forces us to do stuff that we wouldn't otherwise think about doing. What I'm saying is, you know, I listened to some stuff today from some people I have the highest respect for, and I respect their analysis and everything else. If I wasn't, in fact, kind of immersed in local politics, I would swallow everything they say, hook, line, and sinker. But because I'm kind of immersed in politics at the local level, and been that way since I was 20 years old, you know, I'd be like, well, I agree with this, but I don't necessarily agree with that, you know. Like I said, they were talking about Obama today like he was still the president. And there's some stuff that Obama has to be held accountable for. I mean, what
absolutely.
He did with Libya
absolutely.
Is absolutely unforgivable. I mean, that is something, and he has this tremendous propaganda machine now, post-president propaganda machine. You know, there must be like Obama fan clubs and stuff. You know, they be putting stuff out. Don't you wish you had Obama as president now? You know, but man, as time goes on and that shine diminishes, that ugly stain of what he did in Libya, not to mention other places, that is gonna he's not going to be able to escape that. I mean, they are selling black people right now into slavery in Libya right now. On the mainstream news, they said Nigeria was sending planes to Libya to get African refugees out of Libya so they won't be sold into slavery. Can you believe that?
And there's no discussion of it.
And no discussion of it. And won't be any discussion of it, because to discuss it, you'd have to talk about Obama, which is, you know, the 21st century Jesus. It's tough for some people. You think he was Jesus, man. You can't say nothing bad, but I'm telling you, I will tell it, you know, because, you know, some of my left friends, they think I love Obama. Well, I like the good things he did, but there's definitely some stuff that he did with that, and Libya is at the top of the list. I mean, wouldn't that be enough? Bernard, could you or I say that we know of anybody else that overthrew a whole nation and took a nation from being one of the most progressive societies on the continent to being in total chaos.
Right.
I mean, how much more sin than that would you need to go to hell?
Not only that, he opened the door for AFRICOM to become more prolific in Africa.
That's right, in Africa. That's right. That's right. You know, and as like I said, when this shine wears off, when Trump is going away, and people ain't scared no more, and a little more willing to really handle the truth or listen to the truth, that shine that Obama has, that shit's going to diminish, man. Because what was done in Libya was treachery, was treacherous. You know, that country had the highest standard of living on the African continent. Now it's a backwater, you know, it's not even a state anymore for all practical purposes. I mean, it's a state in name only.
But you know that's part and parcel of the dumbing down of America. Not that it was ever really smart, but people don't know history. They don't know American history, much less about what's happening on the continent of Africa.
Right. And people want simple answers. They want to say, we're not even talking about history. Libya just happened. This ain't something that happened. Like, we talk about, you know, European colonialism in the 19th century. This just happened. But people don't want if I go into a church, I'm going, you know, I'm speaking in 7 churches this King weekend, Bernard. I have 8 speaking engagements, and 7 of them are in church to talk for the King holiday. And you can bet if I discuss this Libya thing in any of them churches, I will not get any applause for that. Because Obama and Michelle, you might as well be talking about Jesus and Mary.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree.
You might as well be talking about Jesus and Mary. See, you and I can have that conversation about Obama. You know, but me and my mother, we can't have that conversation. Because everybody gonna end up mad.
Oh, my mother has already given it. You know, it's like one of her friends. His name is Obama. She don't say Obama. You know,
right?
And my mother was never interested in politics, but when Obama and you know, when he got into office, she watches MSNBC and CNN the time.
That's right.
And see, that's what the left could have taken advantage of, this interest.
Right.
And
right.
not come out nasty, talking negative about Obama. Talk about the system, and people will make the connection.
Right. Well, you know, Cornel West tried to do that, and they demonized him.
Yeah.
Man, they have done a job on Cornel tried to talk about policy. And this. Still, there is a concerted campaign going on with the media right now to totally discredit Cornel West because he critiques other black people. And see, this is what happens when you push a people so far down. They yearn for unity so much. They see their people so far down in the muck and mire, and they yearn for unity so much that for anybody to say anything critical about anybody else in terms of thinking, people interpret that as you not trying to unify our people.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You don't want our people to be unified. Why are you attacking it? How come black people can't just get along with each other?
Yeah, why are you attacking the brother?
That's right, because that's what Cornell is going through right now with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Because Cornell is carrying out a critique of Coates. It's not nasty. You know, he's trying to critique the pipe. Everybody, why is Cornel West hating on Ta-Nehisi Coates? You know. But this prevents any kind of real intellectual or analytical discussion. you know. And I just take my hat off to Cornell that he's positioned himself by being, you know, a college professor and author of many books and all of that. He's positioned himself so he could take them. He can take them blow because he, you know, he got a way to make a living. You know, but they went after Tavis. They went after Tavis before the sex thing. They're going to use the sex thing to finish him off or try to use it because he's fighting back. Tavis is fighting back, you know. I'm not saying he's right or wrong because I don't know the details, you know, but I know, you know, it involves the sex thing, you know, sexual harassment thing. But I think there's something else in there because, remember, Tavis was all the rage, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember Tavis was on the cover of a magazine talking about the media empire of Tavis Smiley. Man, soon as him and Cornell started criticizing Obama, they moved Tavis from the East Coast to the West Coast, right? Am I right or wrong?
That's right.
They took his show out of New York, the major media, and they moved him to Los Angeles. They took him out of prime time. I don't even know when Tavis' show come on so late. And they took him off FM and put him on AM. So much for the empire, right? You know, it's a shame, man, how they do people who try to, you know, try to carry out struggle in a principled way. Because, see, and that just kind of underscores what our left friends say about Obama, that in fact he's the spearhead for U.S. imperialism. So, you know, they make it difficult because he's black. It makes it difficult for you to attack him. Because right now, Obama's rating in the black community is probably 110%.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah, Trump pushed it past 100.
Trump pushed it past 100, man. People wishing they had Obama back. But, see, this is the trick bag they put you in because they would have you believe that before Trump, that we were in some type of neoliberal paradise. And it wasn't no paradise. And that's the real trick bag we in building this movement against Trump. It's got to be more. It's got to be more than just removing Trump. But our left friends have to understand, our left brothers and sisters have to understand that you've got to get the low-hanging fruit first. If Trump is going to be impeached, he should be impeached. And people say, well, we can't impeach Trump. We're going to get Pence. Well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But you can't, like, well, we're going to pick the fruit off the top of the tree and not pick the fruit off in the branches that we can reach without a ladder. Because if Trump is impeached, it will delegitimize, it will add delegitimacy to all of them Republicans, Pence included. And who knows, if it's deep enough, if Trump goes, Pence might have to go with it. You know, an impeachment will aid the effort to flip the Congress in either 18 or 20. Personally, I don't think the impeachment is going to happen. I think the investigation is just going to go on and on and on. And I think that Trump is probably going to have to be defeated at the ballot box.
I agree with you. I've had a lot of discussions. My friends, folks that I've talked to, especially here in North Carolina, that saying, you know, with all of this information coming out that he's going to be impeached. I said, you know, when this information comes out, Trump's going to say, I don't believe it. I'm not going anywhere. And so then you got a constitutional crisis.
Right.
And
right.
By the time they straighten that out, his term will be over.
Right.
If they straighten it out.
If they straighten it out. See, as long as they got a majority in the Congress, they are not going to impeach Trump.
Right, and you see some of his biggest critics moving to support him now.
That's right. Even Bannon, J. just today, was it this morning?
Apologizing.
Bannon had to walk back all that stuff he said. Because the billionaire Mercer family said, we're not going to support
your money.
You.
Yeah.
We ain't giving you no more money. Bannon had to walk all that shit back. If he said it all, he can't deny that he said any of that.
Like Gil Scott-Heron said, it's all about money in the land of milk and honey.
That's right. That's right, man.
So listen, Larry Ham, this could go on for another couple of hours as we usually do.
We feel good. We feel good.
But what I'm going to do is, as I said, I've been working with Radio Justice in California, and going to try and bring you on a regular basis.
And well, I'd like
hopefully
that.
You'll be available. Because I think, like, you know, and I wanted to see if we can get some of the folks from the West Coast to come and share with us on the East Coast. Because one of the things that we need to do is we need to know what's going on in other areas. And there are a lot of talented young men and women. I'm really surprised at the number of young women who have developed a real cogent analysis of what's going on in this country.
Oh, yeah. The women are woke, brother.
Ah, you are woke. Okay.
Yeah, the women are woke. It'll be a lot of women running for office.
Which is fine with me, because I judge people based on their ideas, not on their agenda.
Right. And that's the way we should judge them, because, you know, look at Margaret Thatcher. She was a woman.
Maggie.
You know, look at Sarah Palin. She was a woman. You know, gender does not necessarily respect political tendency.
That's right.
You know. You could have right-wing women, right-wing black people, right-wing Puerto Ricans, and everything, as we still so often see. You know, but
one of the saddest things you want to see is these Negroes coming up and supporting Trump, and when they're asked real tough questions, the answers that they give are just so stupid. That a lot of times, I know I was watching on CNN, and a lot of times what they do is they wind up having to close down the interview because it just isn't going
anywhere.
They got
to walk away.
Yeah.
Because what can they say to possibly defend that bullshit? That we should be in both parties? I mean, that's the best line. That's their most popular line. We should be in both parties.
Yeah.
You know? What? That's like, you know... in Germany, telling Germans we should be in the Nazi party, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? We should be in the Social Democratic Party, and we should be in the Nazi party, too. That's crazy.
So I do want to thank you for sharing with us today. And as I said, I will be back to you.
All right.
Okay.
All right, man. Take care.
Okay, you too. And that was Larry Ham from the People's Organization for Progress, known here on the East Coast as POP. And I suggest that you go to the internet and take a look at some of the things that they've been involved with. They've really been doing some really, really good work. They've been consistent for decades now.
I would love to be here when I can be more fully in depth on this subject, because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it. I'm saying that all organized present religions are male chauvinist murder cults. And I say there is no exception. Why I wanted to be here earlier, I wanted to deal with our relationship with the people of the world and the fact that we created peaceful nations that had no word for jail because no one had ever gone to one. No word for old people's home because no one had ever thrown away grandma and grandpa. No word for orphanages. We did all of this. And over half of human civilization was over before we knew that a European was in the world. Before he wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window. Now, Africa has always and still is the prize for the whole world. We as a people have always been the world's richest people, culturally rich, mineral rich. We have always been the prize because we have always had and still have something that other people won't, think they can't do without, and don't care to pay for. Because we have always been the prize, we have been under siege for over 3,000 years. Nothing that ever brought into Africa from the outside was meant to do the Africans any good. That means all other religions. Islam was the handmaiden of Arab imperialism. Christianity was the handmaiden of European imperialism. The Hebrew faith was the handmaiden of a concept called the chosen people. Now, if God is kind and God is merciful and God has no stepchildren, he won't choose one over the other. And to say he chose some people, you're making him a bigot. And to say that he endorsed enslavement of one people over the other, you're making him an accessory to murder. The Arabs used Islam to rationalize their slavery and their imperialism. The Europeans used Christianity to rationalize their slavery and imperialism. Who are you kidding about friends in the world? Damn it, if you want a friend, look in the mirror. There's a billion African people on the face of this earth. Why are you buying third-rate junk from third-rate people thinking you can't make it? Why don't you at least make a safety pin to hold your child's diaper together?
Teach.
Who has programmed your mind at thinking you can't make a car? The first man that made a car that had never seen one previously. The Japanese bought cars, bought locomotives, broke them down and studied them, and had a Japanese technician produce each piece, put it together, and had a much better train than the one they copied from. All knowledge in the world belongs to everybody in the world.
Yes.
Who has programmed our mind in assuming that we cannot run a nation and run it well? The main thing imperialism did, slavery and imperialism, they removed African people from the respectful commentary of history. And they tell them something they are still telling them. And all of the organized religions are guilty of this. I favor none of it because Africa didn't need any of it. I'm saying that African belief systems, properly understood, is 10 times better than Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And better for the Africans. Now, you might have some romance with one of these religions. I have no romance with any of them. I have a romance with reality and truth. And the chips can fall where they may after I tell it. As for friends, you have had no friends. When they discovered you, they began to prey on you. Now let's look at our relationship with Western Asia, mistakenly called the Middle East. For 3,000 years, our greatest enemies came from Western Asia. They were trying to avenge the fact that they were once African colonies. You read a book called When Egypt Ruled the East, and you get some of the basic information on this. Now, the first visitors to Africa came in the 1700s BC. These were the people who would later be called Hebrews. Now, black people are ticklish on this because black people think that everything in the Bible is true. I question the intelligence of anyone who thinks everything in the Bible is true or supposed to be true. It's allegory, stories told to illustrate a point at a time when there were very few people reading books. And most of what went into the making of the Bible was copied from Egyptian texts. Now, if you want to get so dewy-eyed over the Bible, which is a carbon copy of a carbon copy, why don't you go back and read the original Egyptian text? Then you see where all these stories started from. You see where the story of the Exodus started from. Now, you get so dewy-eyed, you actually think there was an Exodus. These people walked into Africa. Why couldn't they walk out? Why did they have to go by sea? Why did sea have to part? If you read Egyptian literature, you will discover that the whole story of somebody parting the sea started with about 3,000 years before the Hebrew entrance. I should not use the word Hebrew entrance, but the entrance from Western Asia. Now let's get one thing straight, because black people are confused about all religions. Now, I'm not against any religion. I'm a very spiritual human being. I just don't need a preacher to preach no Ten Commandments to me when he's a backslider going with some sister, some other man's wife. I'm intelligent enough to pick from the Tenth Commandment, not commandments anyway, but the omissions of purity at the great school at Luxor, the great African training school. All right, now, let's get into this Western Asia. I'm saying that the people who came from Western Asia escaping famine did not have any Hebrew faith when they came into Africa. And there's no record of a Hebrew faith before there. Why is it that when they left Africa in the so-called Exodus, they had all three? African culture, an African religion, and an African language. Now look at the origin of so-called people you now refer to as Jews. You're mistaken using that reference, because the word Jew is of European origin. And the people in Europe who call themselves by their name have no relationship to the biblical people of the Hebrew faith. And I'm saying that the people we now call Jews entered world history with their visit to Africa. And when Africa was invaded, 1675 B.C., instead of joining the Africans who had been their beneficiary and saved them from starvation, they joined the enemies of Africa. No one has ever returned any favors to us. As a people, we have always been hospitable to strangers, mostly the wrong strangers. And what we have to understand now, in the period of superior brainwashing, is there is no European answer for African problems. Either Africans find a solution to African problems, or there is no solution, and if you don't find a solution soon, you go back into slavery. We have to stop all of this nonsense about who belongs to what religion when all of them were imposed on us in the first place. We stop all this fight between Muslims and Christians. When neither one of the religions are doing them any good or moving them toward independence. All of them are handmaidens of conquerors. All of them are religions of conquerors. We were naive when we accepted their interpretation of something that we had all along. I'm saying we need to take a good look at ourselves. I'm not talking about burning churches. I'm not talking about getting rid of religions. Understand me well. I am saying that every single thing that touches your life, religious, socially, and politically, must be an instrument of your liberation, or you must throw it into the ash can of history. Develop a liberation Islam.
Yes.
And if you develop a liberation Islam, you have to turn on the supreme slave traders who were in the slave trade 1,000 years before the Europeans, the Arabs. And most brothers who think they're Muslims are merely Arabists. Forerunners, vanguards of Arab propaganda. The Arabs are not above joining the Jews against black people. In America, they're already doing it in Detroit. In America, they're already doing it in real estate. You got some dewy-eyed thing that you got a friend. I still ask you to look at that mirror. And if nothing staring back at you is friendly, then you've got no friends. But this is why you start friends. All right. I'm saying something which you need to reconsider. I'm saying that everything that came into Africa, every people that came into Africa, did not come to do Africa any good. Everyone and every religion and every people who came into Africa declared war on African cultures. They began the bastardization of African people, created a confused mulatto who didn't know whether he's to be loyal to his mother's people or his father's people. That confusion is still here. The fascination for the color of the conqueror and the fascination to go to bed with the conqueror. Now that's raw and mean. But it's true. Now, sometime ago, a North African leader, Gaddafi, was sending some Libyans to study in Europe. And he told them what any good nationalist would tell students going to study. I'm not sending you to Europe to find a wife. I'm sending you to Europe to gain the technology to come back and make Libya a strong nation, a strong Islamic nation, and a strong Arab nation. And you cannot achieve any of this between the legs of a European woman. When is somebody going to get strong enough to tell Africans going to school, you're going to come back home and pair up with a sister, but if you want to pair up over there, stay over there. Now, the one thing we have to look at, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to conclude on this because I've left out a body of information. At the university, I teach an entire course, semester course on Africa's relationship to other people. And I devote several semesters to Africa before Europe, the consequences of the coming of the Greeks, who stole a lot that they think is their culture, stole a lot that you think is Greek philosophy. We've been the victims of propaganda. And yet, if you read the Journal of African Civilization, other works, we have lived in Europe, we have lived in Asia, we've lived in the Americas. The African people have already proved that they can get along with different people, amalgamate their culture with different people without one hint of a war between us. People who come into Africa immediately declare war on African culture. standards of beauty, standards of conduct, and change the African concept of theirs so they can rule through him. This was true of the Greeks, who began the bastardization, again, the European bastardization of Africa. The Western Asians had begun it 3,000 years before that. The Romans, a bunch of well-dressed thugs who could write well but couldn't think, who borrowed practically everything. They laughed at the Africans' concept of Christianity. The African was practicing and not giving it a name. This is why you don't know nothing about the African origins of Christianity. This is why a whole lot of people will not read Ben Yorkinen's The African Origins of the Major Western Religions, Africa, Mother of Western Civilization, a Black Man of the Nile. Because he's telling it like it is, but you also will not read white radicals who identified Africa as the origin of the great religions of the world, especially Alvin Boyd Kuhn in his work, Who is This King of Glory? In Shadow of the Third Century. We have dealt with John Jackson, another radical Black historian, with man, God, and civilization. We let some of our great scholars die in hunger, die wanting for friendship. Now, having devoted my greater portion of my life to scholarship and teaching and digging up information on African people and trying to make African people face reality, I have often said a point that I wish you to consider. I didn't have to do it. I chose to do it. And if I had to do it over again, I would do it better. A lot of talent other than the talent to teach and to research. I've never met a rich man who had a better mind than me. So if I wanted to succeed as a rich man, I could have done that. I never met a crook who wasn't a fool. I could have been a good crook if I chose to be a crook. I chose to be a teacher of African history. I chose to look in the Bible where I couldn't find my people. I started looking for them in the world, and I didn't stop until I found them. And I know why they were left out of the Bible. I know why all the angels are white. You mean to tell me God is merciful, God is kind, and not one little brown or black angel sneaked into heaven? I ain't buying that. Now, the Bible that you get so dewy-eyed over is one of the greatest pieces of propaganda ever written. If you want to read the Bible, why don't you read the Bible one day and read Mein Kampf the next day and see the comparison? That's hard on your mind. Because you think if you don't have Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, you don't have that spirituality. I've got more spirituality after I put all of them down. And I've got more religion after I put all of them down. All right, now let me conclude something that has no conclusion. We have to look at the impact of Europeans on Africa. All impacts have been negative. The Romans laughed at the early African Christians. Finally, for political reasons, they stopped killing Christians and became Christians. I'm saying the Europeans became Christians for political reasons, as the Arabs became Muslim for political reasons, and as the so-called Jews became Hebrews for political reasons. People use organizations for political reasons, and what we get so dewy-eyed and think we're dealing with all the truth. If you look at indigenous African religion belief systems, if you look at the idea when Africans had no churches of any consequence, because these fools came here and said, this is the house of God, and the African looked at that church and said, if God who made the wind, the spring, made the ocean roar, and you gonna tell me he can fit into a little thing you call a church? That is no house of God. So some of them had the common sense enough to move away from it, and some had the common sense to burn it down. I'm saying that you are closer to God when the further way you get away from organized religions that are all handmaidens of conquest. The Roman Empire developed during the early period of Christianity. Remember, the Roman Empire started in Africa. It rose in Africa. It fell in Africa. A lot of people need to stop reading some religious books and read some straight history without fable, without supposition, without myth. Read straight history. Read the Mediterranean world in ancient times. She's a racist bigot, but her chronology is good. And there's a good history of the European trying to move out of Europe into the Mediterranean to find something to eat to put on that gosh darn awful European food. He has solved his problem at the expense of other people. The slave trade liberated Europe from the depressed economy they had created with the so-called crusades and through the famines and the plagues. Europe always solves its problems by preying on people outside of Europe. They are in a position right now that they have betrayed true socialism, which was not of European origin in the first place. And some people are confused between Karl Marx and Groucho Marx. I think a lot of people are Groucho Marxism instead of Karl Marxism. They're funny people. And if you think that that system started in Europe, no system as humane as socialism could have started among a bunch of icebox people who prey on their brothers for their breakfast. Read Palmer Colson's work, The History of the Modern World, especially the early chapters. Now, the evidence of Africans in the New World, the evidence of 1,000 years of civilization before slavery, all of this I'm not discussing because there is no time. But when the Romans disgraced themselves in the mismanagement of Christianity, they created a vacuum. Islam moved into that vacuum. The Africans thought that Islam would get the Romans off of their back. They were right. Islam got the Romans off of their back, and the Arabs jumped on their back, and they're still there, using Islam to justify it. Now, the African military man, because we are the greatest fighting machine in the face of the earth, if we ever discovered this, people are going to start running. Under proper leadership, proper inspiration, properly equipped, the black man is the greatest human fighting machine God ever created, if indeed God created it. I think the gods of Africa created it. Once you lose track of your heritage, you lose track of your liberty in this world. The Europeans doing the slave trade not only read the African out of history, they colonized history, they colonized information about history. They colonized image. They colonized the image of God. Who told you Christ was white? He was born in that part of the world predominantly occupied by non-European people. So you should not get into the argument about whether he's white. All you have to say, was he a Greek? No. Was he a Roman? No. But these were the only people partially white in the area at the time. If he wasn't a Greek, he wasn't a Roman, he was one of those other people. You don't have to argue about the shades of color. So far as you're concerned, once you establish he was not a Roman, he was not a Greek, your conversation is over. If somebody else want to argue about his shade, well, that's their problem. Then if you got a problem with color, then you got a problem with your mother and your father. You have insulted your mother and your father if you don't like what they gave you.
I wear mine like a badge of honor. I dig it. I wear it well.
All right. Love it.
I'm saying, in closing, and I am closing, that what you have to do is take a holistic look. Now that, not only at your position in the world, but your potential in the world. You have to learn how to convert everything into an instrument of liberation or leave it alone. You have to realize there were no Greek fraternities and sororities until they were introduced to secret African societies. People get all dewy-eyed over something that was imposed on them in order to control them.
We've come to the end of our program for today. My name is Bernard White. This has been Emanations on Radio Justice. And until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
Flowing through the heartache of this place, there are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who need this place. Oh, 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 yeah. There's sorrow sadness here, but there's heaven and sunshine too. The spirit of peace moves free and clear, making way for laughter here. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who believe in this place. They live and breathe in this place, yeah. This place.